Welcome to Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. My name is Anthony Galloway, race equity advocate.
Don Eubanks, assistant professor at Metropolitan State University in the School of Social Work and cultural consultant.
Luz Maria Frias, president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
Lee Lee, media professional.
Jonathan Blakely, program director, NPR News.
There are so many themes happening and patterns that are coming up. This is going to be kind of a tour of some of the racial patterns that have been present for us in this last 2 weeks since we've been with you, and we're going to dive right into them. So, Jonathan, you had a clip that kind of spoke to one of those themes that you wanted to listen to.
Yeah, I mean, the shooting death of the unarmed man there in Sacramento. Everyone knows about this story, but for those who may not know, there is a lot of anger. In California and in some parts of the country, if not the entire country, of folks who are connected to this. About maybe a little more than a week ago, a gentleman, 22 years old, Stephon Clark, was shot in his grandmother's backyard by police. Police apparently mistook his cell phone for a gun. He was unarmed, shot in upwards of 20 times. We've all seen this story before, literally. In fact, there is video of this incident. It's quite disturbing. And since that shooting, folks are quite upset. This week, a city council meeting in Sacramento was interrupted by protesters. They had to just call it off.
I think his brother, actually. Yeah. His brother
among,
was actually there.
Among other protesters. Fans were kept from entering the Sacramento Kings basketball game a couple times. Again, I almost feel like broken record, and we are we're replaying this thing again.
And that phone, to be clear, was an iPhone, and it was white. That phone, in particular, that he had, it was white, and the shooting occurred at night, in the evening. It was dark, and there were conflicting stories about, from the police officers themselves and the statements they were making, whether it was they mistook it for a gun, and other times the same police officers said they mistook it for a crowbar. And so this leads to question the credibility of the statements made by the officers that, A, how do you mistake a white phone that's clearly white from the video footage that we see for something other than a phone? And if you're then mistaken it for anything, how do you not understand the difference between a gun or a crowbar? I mean, it goes to credibility.
They compounded it because as officers were showing up, all of a sudden you hear one of them that says mute. And then they all turned the recording, their body cams, so we could no longer hear the conversation that they were having after they realized he was unarmed.
That's all you need to know, right?
Well, I mean, you think of the, and I always play this vision in my mind of the Philando Castile shooting and Diamond and her daughter saying, it's going to be okay, mommy. I mean, I'll never get that out of my mind.
Yes.
But it seems like this shooting and Philando Castile seems like these are a couple of shootings that are sticking in the media.
Well, there's the Laquan McDonald case, too, in Chicago that happened in between that, where he was shot 16 times, and the police officers reported that he was carrying a dangerous weapon, which he wasn't. They were alleging he had a knife. And then the footage shows the police officers going across the street to, I believe it was a Burger King, and attempting to erase the footage, but they, unbeknownst to them, there was a camera above their shoulder showing that they were erasing the footage as well.
There was also the recent shooting in Denver, Colorado, of an Asian man, Stephen Nguyen, who was being mistaken for an escaped convict, and he was shot in his vehicle when it looked like he was reaching for something.
And pattern after pattern. I think we said it here a couple years ago when we were in another string of unarmed officer-involved shootings, and we were at a loss for words, and we came to this, you know, to this point, you know, of being tired of the price of consciousness, or folks being able to understand these, see these patterns, or even believe these patterns, because so many folks are still in a constant state of denial, and you get detoured to all these other things. When will black blood cease to be the price for American consciousness? And we're not learning that pattern. And it's even being reproduced and defended by so many folks because this pattern would threaten the way that I see the world or my outlook on the world. And so now I listen to everything you just said, which are details to your point, Lee, that should be specific, damning, and make folks want to move. And instead, I list all the reasons why it's not this, it's that.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something else about loss for words, because this week at the White House press conference, you know, there's a White House press conference basically daily, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders is the White House spokesman or spokeswoman usually there. So April Ryan, American Urban Radio Network, she's like one of the few people of color in the White House press corps. So she asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the spokeswoman, about not just this shooting, Stephon Clark, but also about Anton Alton Sterling. Sterling?
Alton Sterling. Right, Alton where Sterling. They just found the officers innocent.
Exactly. That was in 2016, that shooting, and they just said no charges will be against police officers in that case. And April asked her about Stephon Clark, and essentially Sanders said, this is a spokeswoman, a terrible incident, of course, and it's something that's a local matter, and it should be left to local authorities. We want to make sure that all law enforcement is carrying out the letter of the law, but this is not something the federal government should weigh into. Okay? All right. That didn't satisfy all the reporters there, so another reporter came back in and said, I want to follow up on April's question. So she says, hang on a second. Just to go back to what April asked you, and this is how that exchange went.
Follow up with April quickly, if I could. You said these are local issues. And with respect, this seems to be an issue that the entire country is grappling with. These tensions between communities of color and police departments. Does the president not need to show leadership on this issue?
Look, we certainly, when the president has talked about a number of issues, we want to find ways to bring the country together, certainly not looking for any place of division. I think you've seen that in the policies that he's put forward. He wants to grow the economy, wants to do that for everybody. He wants a better America for every American, and that's been a repeated thing out of this White House. But when it comes to the authority to on the rulings that have taken place in the last few days, those are things that have to be done at a local level, and they're not federal decisions at this point in time.
There are a lot of African-American moms all across the country feel as though their sons are dying. So doesn't the president feel like he needs to do something about that?
I think we should do every single thing we can every single day to protect the people of this country. I think the president, whether they're black, white, Hispanic, male or female, rich or poor, we look for ways to protect the individuals in this country, particularly children. That's why you've seen the president take an active role over the last several months in school safety and looking at ways. We want to do that across the board, whether a kid is in a school, whether they're at home, no matter where they are in this country, kids should feel safe. And that's why this president has focused on safety and security as a big part of the priorities of this administration, both through securing our borders and stopping the flow of drugs, stopping the flow of gangs, stopping the number of school shootings by the Stop School Violence Act, the background system. I'm not saying it's perfect. And until every child is safe, we can always do more. And we're going to show up every day for work trying to do exactly that. Peter.
It's just okay. All right. And I want to make sure to stress that I view it as a political two-step.
Yep.
That's been done both on the left and the right.
Yep.
Right? But they're particularly adept at it in this particular administration.
There's a bunch of steps going on.
This is a backflip tap dance pirouette.
Holy smokes.
But there's a couple of really important insinuations that are made there. So it's not just a sidestep to leave to try to not answer the question and get off of that. It was done by also putting a few jabs, trying to equate gangs and drugs with what we're talking about in this particular pattern.
Border. And the wall. I mean, she threw everything in there.
Well, and making this country safe. So let's go back to the beginning of March, when there were 6 bomb packages happening in Austin. And the bomber at that point, we now know, was a white young man that factual story is not being understood or conveyed by media, but instead you have these dog whistles. What we're talking about, Anthony, and you saying that, it's a dog whistle, mm-hmm. right? She is inserting a number of dog whistles, stereotypes about who people of color are, criminals, you know, stopping the flow of gangs and crimes and drugs is what she said. But yet we know the most recent example of criminality at a larger level.
Our white
terrorism,
man.
Terrorism has been a pattern of white men.
White
and so
males.
you've got six bombs by this white man who killed a black African-American father mm-hmm. and a 17-year-old young African-American
student.
Neither of whom's lives were humanized, and we were not given their story to understand and to appreciate and to validate, but instead there was just 24/7 coverage until this bomber was discovered. And then afterwards, the headlines are, and I'm reading from a couple of articles, that he came from a tight-knit, godly family.
The bomber.
Okay. As yes. described in the New York Times,
right.
and then that he was described as a challenged young man.
Yes.
Versus the reality that he was terrorizing not only an entire city of Austin, but neighboring areas as well. That's the reality of it,
right.
that is what is factually happening. But the spin on putting these dog whistles in these conversations to generalize who people of color are.
And let me give you a more local example. A few weeks ago, a couple in Van Nuys Heights was taken into custody after their son made a threat at school to shoot someone. And they went to the family's home and they found guns galore, stuff that were illegal, right? And so they were arrested, blah, blah, blah. WCCO TV, they led with that story that night. And the tease was, find out why they're just like everybody else, just regular Minnesotans. That was the effing tease that Frank Vassalaro said on air. And I was like, I have to watch this. And the whole piece was friends, the people's lawyer, their neighbors saying, oh, they're just this great family. They're just regular people. And I'm like,
right.
they have weapons that are illegal. Their son's threatening other children's lives with it. Yet the story we hear is they're just like us.
And that had happened, if I remember correctly, a few days after the Parkland shooting.
Yes.
And so, again, pattern. This sounds every bit of separate and unequal, and yet in that same clip that we just heard, this is a role for local authorities. There is no role for the federal government. But then we're going to do all these other things that don't deal with any of it. And I just can't. I'm perplexed as to why I can't just in the position of authority say, here's the pattern. Doesn't take a whole lot. But all that the community is asking you to do is to acknowledge that you see this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, the inability to do so speaks volumes.
But and acknowledging speaks volumes. Sometimes you just say, yes,
yes,
a
right.
It fits his administration's pattern and Trump's pattern that just tap dance around the issue, never, ever, ever addressing it from where we would expect leadership would come from.
But how many times have you called someone out, a white person out, on some sort of racist thing, and their response has been the same as Sarah Huckabee Sanders's?
Very much
broad,
so, regardless
all,
of right
around,
or left.
Tiptoeing all around it. There was a one of my high school friends posted a picture of her Halloween costume a few years ago, and she was a hip-hop person. That was the title that she gave her
costume.
Her costume. And I said, have you seen Dear White People? I said, and she came back at me and said, that was inappropriate. I modeled my costume actually after an actual person. I just didn't name that person in the title that I gave, but you didn't know that. So you can't call me out on that.
And who's this person?
She never said.
And this is one of the issues I have when folks politicize their responses around race, because I've experienced not only that and being part of being at the campus of the University of Minnesota, where we not so tactfully interrupted several blackface parties, right, that aren't even on the official reporting, right? And so, but you see students who come from many different political backgrounds. And that's one thing I want to stress here is that this. Yes, they're adept at this in this administration, but they're not the only ones to do it. And even, and I have to come back to the statement around acknowledging, because I would love to acknowledge and say, I see the pattern, because now I have to, there's some accountability then I can hold on to. But even that accountability, when folks have said, they have named directly the exact pattern that people want them to say, and then haven't done any work to back that up on the left, is also problematic. And but we in the communities of color have these conversations regardless of what administration is there. And it's like folks aren't willing to acknowledge and be affected by the patterns that are right in front of your face. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the issues and challenges I'm really frustrated in, is what do you do when folks have very adept ways to say the right words and ignore your patterns, or just ignore the pattern outright? Mm-hmm. Both of those are problematic, and you're stuck trying to figure out what to do.
You know, that's an interesting point, because I think with Stephon Clark's shooting, with all the incidents that have happened since the last time we were together, and it's only been 2 weeks, and it takes an emotional toll, you know. And you know, since we started Counter Stories, it really saddens me that we're here almost 4 years later, talking about the exact same thing.
And you could hear the exasperation in the reporters' voices. They're all like, yes. What about?
Well, and then the pain in Stephon Clark's grandmother. So it was his grandmother's house. And based on the reports, the officers went in and questioned Stephon Clark's grandmother at length for over an hour, and other family members. And it wasn't until after that interrogation concluded that they disclosed that it was Stephon Clark in the backyard.
That it was her grandson.
That it was her grandson.
I didn't know that.
Wait, so she didn't know that he had been shot yet.
Right. She thought it was sounds at a distance. And they were asking the family members about the sounds at a distance. So here again, the dehumanization of an African-American individual, because it happens to both men and women, unfortunately, being left to die. And there's no regard for the humanity of that. And even in the footage, if you've watched the video footage, they shoot him 20 times and proceed thereafter for upwards, I think, of close to 5 minutes, continue to ask him questions in terms of his ability to move or not before they come to render, quote-unquote, assistance to him. It is heart-wrenching when you put all these facts together and think about, again, the pain that is not only felt by the family and the community, but the nation as a whole.
Let me
add to that quickly. What happened in Denver, there was a man in the car with Stephen Nguyen called Rafael Landeros, who was also shot, taken to the hospital. They believed that he was the escaped convict. Well, when he was released from the hospital, police arrested him anyway for other warrants not related to the situation at all. But so they could make an arrest, that they had made an arrest in this case, this shooting, that this guy had these other non-related warrants. So he went to the hospital because he was shot, because they thought he was someone else. He came out and they arrested him, so they're justified.
It's incredible. And it just, you know, it's like after a while, your insides feel deadened. Has anyone heard any humanizing story about Stephon Clark's grandmother? Do we know what she does? Do we know she's retired? Do we know she came from a God-fearing family? Do we know, you know, these would all be the same things that we've seen in the bomber's case in Austin, mm-hmm. Texas, which is woefully missing from this scenario. Now, I don't, you know, since we don't get, you know, Sacramento TV, I bet they're not running it.
But, you know, the thing is that when this happened, and I heard it via Facebook, I have a lot of family in Sacramento, and I started seeing pictures, people on Facebook who are my friends are going, let's humanize this, right? It's just what you're saying. My husband watches MSNBC like 24/7, so I said, turn the news on and let's see what they're saying. It was all about some stripper or playboy playmate 24/7.
Well, we haven't even brought that up.
And there was nothing about this. There was nothing about this at all.
Yes.
Can I ask you, so what's your family members, as folks who live in Sacramento, how is this affecting them?
In the last couple of days, there's been a lot of Hmong Black Alliance talk.
Interesting.
Oh, really?
Which is something that doesn't happen very often. There's a lot of tension there. But in the past couple of days, there's been a lot of talk about how we really need to come together because we're experiencing these, especially after the shooting in Denver.
Mm-hmm. Right? Well, we had local shootings where that same question had to come up of a Hmong man.
Yeah, Hmong man shot, and there were protests, there were walks, and Black folks showed up.
Mm. So we're talking about alliances. And the other thought that comes to mind, separate but yet related, is March for Our Lives mm-hmm. with the Parkland shooting mm-hmm. that happened just a week ago.
Talking about patterns of different representation.
Right, where that movement by the survivors of the Parkland shootings began then a movement. Mm-hmm. And the movement then visibly wasn't inclusive of students of color, although Emma Gonzalez, one of the three main spokespeople, is Latina mm-hmm. And is being attacked right now, actually, by a congressional member because she's of Cuban descent. And the criticisms first came to light in social media again by folks that have been involved in the lives for the movement for Black Lives, but also just in their own cities trying to change the just laws on gun, everyday violence, yeah. right?
Something that's an ongoing thing ongoing. That doesn't get talked about. So there's an assumption that that doesn't happen. Like this is a new thing. These folks
or that it doesn't
ground.
Count, that it's exactly. not a priority because it's their fault in that neighborhood to have that type of violence. It's their problem. Yeah.
Going back to the dog whistle by Sarah.
That's right. More dog whistling. But what's been impressive is to see the movement related to March for Our Lives, the Never Again movement, begin to incorporate and learn and acknowledge, to your point earlier, Anthony, the omissions, you know, mm-hmm. the missteps that they initially had taken, and they pivoted then. And then we see then the students who took front stage at the D.C. Protest, they were given quite a bit of stage time. And whether it was young Latinx youth mm-hmm. or African-American youth, it was impressive. And that's a lesson for all of us as to what you can do once something's been pointed
when
out to you.
You're inclusive and you acknowledge.
That's right. And, well, and they did that.
But one step further, inclusive, acknowledge, and then acted upon it by changing and moving out the way, creating more space, adjusting the plans to be like, oh, you know what? You're right about that pattern, and then keeping mm-hmm. it moving.
Well, you couldn't go to the District of Columbia. You couldn't go to the nation's capital and not talk about gun violence where there was a problem. You know?
And so were there Asian representatives there?
Yes.
I didn't see any.
Yes.
And I was at a conference
I
for young immigrants, so
any,
I didn't see anything.
I didn't see any indigenous youth.
Both are not as visible as you want them.
Exactly.
But both involved, right? And that's important. That's important
right.
to call
so
out
because when we say inclusivity, but we feel like we're still missing, mm-hmm. then it's not as inclusive as we would like.
True indeed.
And so I know I missed those parts, but I do agree that at least they included a couple of other groups in there with those messages. And I thought that was keenly important, and it gave me hope for that generation.
Well, it feels like they get it.
Huh?
They get it.
Yes.
It's not just that
exactly.
they get it. It's that adults can learn from this because the Parkland kids were kind of criticized. Or not criticized, but people started saying, hey, Black kids have been saying this kind of stuff for years, and no one pays attention to it but these white kids. And so then the Parkland kids said, hey, let's connect with those Black kids.
And they actually went to Chicago.
Right.
They went to other cities to connect with them.
They took this criticism, or they took this thing that people are saying poorly about their movement, and they made it positive.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we got to see the granddaughter of Martin Luther King.
Right. Right.
That was a moment.
You stress these powerful moments, but there is something that is done to you There seems to be a disconnect between these patterns and how these patterns play out. We actually have we got pushback now for letters that were sent to many school districts to investigate the disparate referrals, you know, which connect directly to the assumptions that are made by the officer in the Stephen Clark case and all these places and patterns that we're talking about, right? This assumption of bad actors, the dog whistle that Sarah Huckabee is talking about trying to equate.
Why didn't he just listen to the cops?
Exactly.
We hear that all the time.
And right. I end up finding right. a whole lot of folks, again, from multiple political backgrounds, right? And then from an education sense, saying, you know, well, this is something that the parents need to teach more discipline to their students. And I got to go back up and say, hold on. We're not talking about behavior in general, which has its own problematic patterns that you're not acknowledging. For the same behaviors, this huge disparity in treatment. For the same thing. Mm-hmm. Separate but unequal.
Well, I heard on NPR earlier in the day, they were having a conversation about mental health. Mm. And a woman called in explaining the different treatment she's noticed between one child. She has a child who is African-American, right? Or not her child, but a grandchild. Mm. And another one that's white. They both have behavioral problems in school surrounded to their anxiety. And she couldn't help but notice that when it involves her grandchild of color, the advice they get is when this child acts up, the police and juvenile detention should be notified in order to address this behavior. When the white child's behavior is the same, the advice that child received is that they should notify the mental health providers and get that child the help they need. Exactly. And so here's this white grandmother talking about this on NPR, and she's saying, now, I'm not saying racism is involved here, but I have seen the difference in how these two children.
So in other words.
Exactly.
So, Anthony, to your point as well, 3 days ago, a man with a loaded handgun wearing a bulletproof vest in Chicago and carrying a bag of SWAT equipment.
A white male.
A white male's getting to that. Thank you. believe was stolen from New York City police, was arrested at Chicago's busiest train station. So 21-year-old Isaiah Malulua was arrested Friday morning at Union Station ticket counter and charged with the unlawful use and a bunch of things. The reason he was called to the police attention was that the police dog sniffed explosive residue in an unattended bag that, you know, apparently is connected to him. The point is, full body, you know, armor,
loaded gun
in the middle of a train station
with bomb smelling residue.
But somehow
he's arrested alive.
That's the point. He's alive. The fear for the police officers' lives were not such that they needed to shoot him
and kill him
the way the unarmed black men have in our country.
The responses to it, the responses, direct arguments on that same conversation
yes.
I've had with friends who think very differently than I do is, well, you're not going to shoot somebody when you think there's a bomb involved because you could blow up the whole train station. I had to say, just think about that. That is a fair point.
Yeah, that is.
That's a really solid fair point.
It is.
But in response to me bringing up the pattern, which is that issue, the sidestep into this kind of zoom in, zoom out, mm-hmm. however it gets me to not talk about this pattern that right. is that can't be ignored, is the response.
To those people, I would say, but what about also that Stephon Clark didn't have a weapon?
Well,
right?
But again, that's the conversation that I feel like we keep going, we keep being pulled to. Is individual examples and individualizing, right? Which is the same thing we heard in the Sarah Huckabee quote. Not getting into she said specifically, no divisions anywhere. You know, trying to, we're all the same.
Yeah.
Trying
right.
to the all lives matter no. type thing, which then says, now I don't have to deal with the very specific pattern that you're talking about because I don't have an answer for. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. if we keep bringing it up, if we keep pointing out the dichotomy in this whole, all these scenarios that we're talking about, then we're accused of being racist.
And that's the pattern. And I tell students that I work with all the time, you know, just sit back and look for patterns, coded language, and institutions, right? Look for the patterns that are being ignored, the coded language and dog whistles that are there, and then what pieces of our institution are backing all of those things up, yeah. Intentional or unintentional, right?
I happen to listen to Channel 9 Fox News coverage of the Stephon Clark shooting and the subsequent protest in the City Hall, but the way they framed that story, because they immediately then went to the protesters, Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. which becomes code word for them. And it signals the audience that listens to Fox. And I thought, wow.
Well, it also folks who, you know, and again, we have to acknowledge that not every cop is bad. And we're not in those situations. So what will we do? I don't know what I would do. Having said that, you know, but that's, you talk about how folks are in interpreting and taking this in. Cops are police officers, firefighters, all folks who serve are hearing totally different narratives right now.
Right.
And inaccurate ones that don't speak to the patterns, which if we have those type of dialogues, folks aren't disarmed. When I go into rooms full of folks having to engage in racial discourse and uncovering patterns, you know, folks, when you're presented with real information on the ground and you're in a space where you have to chew on those things, it's a lot harder to oscillate between all of these different views. And let me say specifically on the point around, you know, the responses that you hear and the code words there, there are just as many code words on the left. I get folks on the left who I could walk into a room. And I can say all of these particular code words. For example, I can walk in and I can start talking about white supremacy and white privilege and immediately have a room of audience folks on the left who will breathe. And all of a sudden, the urgency starts to run out of the room because he's saying the right words and he's Black. It never gets around to the action that's required that will be uncomfortable. I'm really getting incensed with how I'm watching patterns, coded language, and institutions play out in, because critical race theory has a critique of liberalism and conservatism in this regard and how in different ways that they utilize race for inaction for the patterns that communities are bringing up.
So would this be a good time to raise what's going on with this movement in London that's now reaching the U.S.? Mm. And I'm reading from a letter that was sent and was shared on social media by actually a good friend of mine who's Muslim. And it's a flyer, it's a letter that big bold at the top says, Punish a Muslim Day, April 3rd, 2018. There will be various levels in terms of incentivizing you to do more in terms of punishing a Muslim by points. So 10 points for verbally abusing, 25 points for pulling the headscarf off of a Muslim woman, and it goes down incrementally. In terms of more points down the list, 1,000 points for burning or bombing a mosque, and then 2,500 points for nuking Mecca. And I'm reading from the document.
Wait, where are you getting this? Because I didn't see any of this on my social.
Well, do you have enough Muslim friends?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, you have a very good point
from my friends who are Muslim. And it says, for further information, please contact. And it has the organization's name and address in London. And, you know, so my point in all this goes to, again, stereotyping and who really is a terrorist, right? Mm-hmm. So would this constitute as terrorism?
I think so.
And in the U.S., hopefully, hate crimes, you know, would be something that law enforcement would pursue. But it's also going back to an earlier point of the narrative that's created as to who is engaging in this terrorist activity. And we know that quite a bit of leaders and media typically look to the Muslim community or the Black or brown community to be the terrorist, when in fact, again, going back in the U.S., the bombings, the mass bombings that have occurred, the mass shootings that have occurred in not only schools but theaters and other public spaces in the U.S. in the last 10 years at least.
Or longer. When did Timothy McVeigh blow up Oklahoma City?
Have not been people of color or indigenous people.
Patterns.
Yes.
Patterns of disparate treatment. Right, continuation of separate, and I keep
also
bringing
the pattern of trying to trying to harm the other.
Mm.
Right? I mean, after there was a, 10 years ago, there was the Wisconsin hunting incident where the lone man shot some white people.
Right.
Then there were bumper stickers going around saying, save a deer, kill a Hmong.
Well, which are redressing.
Yeah, like, but that came out of the 80s from the hunting and fishing rights of Native Americans in Wisconsin.
Right. And
and that's where they created the bumper stickers that said, save a deer, spear an Indian.
Wow.
And
so it just keeps going and exactly. going and going.
They just substitute the community.
We can detach ourselves from some of these things by saying, oh, the thing that you just read, Lewis, for the London thing, that's just somebody trying to rouse or somebody trying to troll, and it's fake. And then somebody else picks it up and assumes that it's real, even mm-hmm. if it is mm-hmm. fake. And then it gets played out where I see it most often playing out with kids. All right. Just because that's where I spend a lot of my work, my day to day work. And these kids will pick up these patterns and tropes, and then I start seeing students respond to it. This past Saturday, we're at the last institute on the Civil Rights Research Institute before me and a group of students go on a tour to Selma and in Memphis. We're actually going to be there on the 50th anniversary at the Lorraine Motel at that museum. And the students are sharing their racial autobiographies. This is a chance for them to go back and look at all the experiences. What do they see now that they look at these patterns throughout history? And over and over again, students of color in particular start to recount all these narratives that have actually hit at almost every single stereotype and pattern of speech, negative speech, terroristic speech, and things like that imposed on them in their school environments. Every single student had that narrative, right? And those patterns then turn into behaviors, then turn into direct actions of students coming to school and having the N-word drawn across their locker. We assume that that's something that you hear back in the day. Patterns of whole, you know, a ski team coming in dressed as thugs and stuff like that, big air quotes, because they're all white, right? And incensing a population. And the only outcome of that is students being arrested for trying to push past a security guard to get the sign that said, we want to have a school-wide dialogue about this because they didn't get the stamp from administration, right? And so even in all these patterns, when folks start to raise them up, the pattern becomes what? Hostile work environments, mm-hmm. where all of a sudden you're ostracizing your work environment. Or the pattern of you trying to bring up conversations like this and being met by a predominantly white workforce saying, or trying to target you as somebody who's trying to start something or rouse something
because
you want to have this one.
Yeah,
or you're angry.
We're angry because mm-hmm. we always, what's the response? Wait a minute. How come it's always got to be about race? Mm-hmm. You know, and I had a young...
Because often it is.
It always is. You know, I had a student that I met with last week, young Native American woman. And so she was sharing with me some of her background. Mm-hmm. And she's from the Lower Sioux community. And in the conversation, I kind of mentioned to her because we were talking about comparative racial class she's taken. Anyways, I had mentioned how... You know, when I went up to Mille Lacs the first time, was the first time I heard the term timber mm-hmm. used to describe American Indians. And I made a comment once in class that it always amazed me how some folks can get very creative when they think up these derogatory names for us. So she looked at me and she says, oh, well, down there they call us prairie
mm-hmm.
So it's geographical, right?
Yeah.
And it's the creativity of individuals to, you know, keep us down. But in terms of this, you know, I'm going back to Sarah's comments now in terms of how she claims the administration has been doing all this to pull together the divisiveness in this country. And then, was it early this week or last week that they announced for the 2020 census that they're going to add a new question on that questionnaire, and that question is, are you a citizen? Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct, the question. Yeah. So that was just announced, and I thought you might want to know that the U.S. Census first was established in 1790. over 200 years ago, 1790, and had not been a question until, and then there was an instance in 1950 when it was appeared, and then wasn't used since then. It is on what's called the American Community Survey, and the American Community Survey is different than the U.S. Census, and it's an informal way, and it's a much more comprehensive document. When I ran a department for the city of St. Paul, we had as a special project the U.S. Census, 2010 U.S. Census, actually. And so I got to learn a lot about the U.S. Census and its importance. And at that point, for every person that was not counted, the state or the city stood to lose $10,000 for each person that was not, in terms of appropriations and the equations that go into how a city and a county and a state is funded. The American Community Survey is a longer document, as I explained, and it's not sent to everybody. So the U.S. Census form is sent to everybody, much shorter, and it does not include that question. The American Community Survey is much longer and is a sample population. And according to the Constitution, the U.S. Census is supposed to be just an enumeration, just body count, versus an exact knowledge of all the demographics in a household. And the concern is, as Don, you were alluding to, is that many families will not answer the question at all, will not answer the and return the census. Mm-hmm. And that goes to losing money for that particular governmental unit, but also the representation in Congress as a result. And the issue here really is about
one of the issues is
a chilling effect on families who are of mixed status. So you may have families who have U.S. citizens as well as what are called green card holders. So they're lawfully here in this country, but they have not pursued a U.S. citizenship status for whatever reason, whether they're unable to, they can't afford it because that fee has more than tripled in the last 10, 15 years. There's a variety of reasons as to language might be or age might be a detriment to their capacity to be able to answer and go through the citizenship exam. The point being that it didn't come in until after the process had been completed for the approval of the actual census form.
See, and the thing is, I think when a lot of people see this issue, a lot of people who are pro-wall or anti-DACA are saying, well, it's good. We shouldn't count undocumented immigrants. This is not just affecting undocumented immigrants, people. Right, this affects refugees who are here lawfully
and green card holders.
Exactly. I have half my family are still just green card holders. I haven't gone through the process for whatever reason, like you were saying, to become citizens. And I remember when I first learned about the census, the big thing was it doesn't matter your citizenship status. We just want to know how many people are in the country. And I thought that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. And this is I learned about this in like sixth grade. Mm-hmm. You know, and knowing that my uncles and my aunties were have refugee status but are not citizens, I thought that makes so much sense.
Having worked for the state, that question is significant because if we don't get accurate counts, states, counties, and everyone else loses when it comes to per capita funding. And that's how the federal government bases their state block grants that they fund to the states is based on population. And so this is going to have an impact in many different areas across the board. And again, coming back to what Sarah was attempting to say in terms of how this administration has been working to kind of pull us all together, Trump just announced that he's removing the safeguards in place for librarians.
And a lot of these decisions folks feel like they have backing and support for many different decisions based on patterns that, as we are discussing here, are very ignorant of not only what is really on the ground, what's real in terms of the data, but ignorant of these patterns that folks of color have been screaming for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'll leave us with this. James Baldwin says it's certain in any case that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have. Mm. And is that not what we've been talking about in this disparate treatment? but trying to make sure that there's finally justice experienced by a large population of folks in this country. You've been listening to Counter Stories. My name is Anthony Galloway.
Don Eubanks.
Luz Maria Frias.
Lily.
Jonathan Blakely.
We'll see you next time.